Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Sheer Looks Book Club podcast with me, Heather Steele, and Georgina Vasky. Today we're joined by a very special guest, Bea Carvalho, who's Waterstones Head of Books. Welcome, Bea. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
I know, excited. So towards the end of the podcast, we're going to be chatting to Bea about her life, her job, the books you've been loving recently, plus excitingly, the books for 2024 that you're really excited about. So lots to look forward to there. But first of all, we're going to be obviously talking about All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. So Georgina, when we were picking our books for this year, this was sort of quite high up on our list from the beginning because you read it years ago. And I remember being on a podcast with you and you were raving about it. And I hadn't quite got around to reading it myself. So I was like, Now is our chance.
Yeah, I think I read it back in 2019. It was originally published in 2014. So even I was a bit late to it. It was one of those books that just stayed with me.
Yeah.
Because as we'll get on to, it's just so vivid how it's written. And I think it really, it really touches you. And then it kind of came back into our minds was the Netflix series coming out, and suddenly we were seeing it everywhere again. That was the kind of
why not now.
Exactly,
as with all the Sheer Looks Book Club podcasts, we're using comments that you've all kindly left on our community to sort of use as talking points. So yeah, we'll get straight into it, and obviously as usual, spoilers alert, we're going to be talking about everything, the ending. So yeah, if you haven't read it yet, then come back once you have. Let's dive in. In general, what did you think of the book, Bea?
Oh, well, it's just a fantastic book, isn't it? I mean, I think at its heart, it's quite traditional. It's quite traditional historical storytelling, but it's done in a really contemporary, clever way. So I think there's just so much for so many different kinds of readers to latch onto. And it's really become kind of one of those benchmark books for historical fiction, which just, you know, has really set the standard for the last few years.
I think obviously it won the Pulitzer Prize when it came out. And I think sometimes people might think that some of the books that win like the Booker or the Pulitzer might be a bit weighty and inaccessible. And I feel like this, even though you might look at the length of it, not knowing about it and be like, wow, that's quite a doorstopper. There's so much for, like you say, for people to take away from. And it's like written incredibly, but it's still like really accessible and yeah, a good, easy read. So I feel like that's played into why so many people love it as well.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting what you said about books being prize winners, because I find that that often fills me with a sort of, not quite a sense of dread, but a real fear that it's going to be heavy going or just very deep or, you know, just something to kind of really wade through and reward it, obviously, but also maybe kind of a little bit more intellectual than perhaps I always feel like reading. And I think what I loved about this book was it was just so instantly grabbing you and pulling you in to their lives, all the different characters. It's so rich. I'm also not one who gravitates towards historical fiction normally. But again, it's just done. The stories are told in such a character-centered way that it's actually about people in a certain situation rather than history.
Yes.
Although it obviously is about history, but it's, to me, it's about the people more than anything.
I was gripped. I started reading it the weekend. Spoiler alert, I left it quite last minute. From the off, it was like chapter, different perspectives. And I was, very, very quickly absorbed in it and, managed to race through it. So.
Well, and so did one of our readers on the community. So Vanessa said, I finished this book in 3 days.
Bit like me.
It was so engrossing. When I was reading it, I felt I was in the book. Sometimes, especially at the beginning, it was a bit slow, but then what a whirlwind of emotions. I think it's really interesting at this point to talk about maybe the pace and the chronology of the book and the kind of the reveals along the way. I think if we start with the pace, to me, it feels like you've got these very short chapters, which definitely appeal to me. It feels quite filming, quite scenic. You're constantly flipping around, so you really have to concentrate hard. What did you think of that technique?
I think having it kind of told through those episodes really helps with the momentum. There's just a really, really kind of zippy pace to it, which means that it's never dry in the way that those quite traditional histories can be, which really helps. And actually the skipping around in the narrative kind of really keeps building that tension along the way. And the sense that actually some of those reveals come quite suddenly and shockingly. Yeah. It's like real life. And I think that, again, really helps with the connectivity to the plot.
Yeah. Yeah, what did you think, Heather?
I found it very easy to read. Like, some of the chapters were a page long, if that, weren't they? But no, for me, it worked really well. I liked it. It's sort of the two, it was Verna and Mary Law to begin with, wasn't it? And then suddenly Von Rumpel's a voice that he wasn't dropped in immediately, but I liked that he just suddenly appeared and it's like, who's this guy? What's he adding to the story? And I, thought it worked really well.
Yeah, and that becomes, I think, particularly powerful at the end where you start obviously getting Jutta in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And then obviously right at the end, it's 2014 and Mary Law and her grandson. And I feel like, well, we'll talk about the ending later, but you know, I really liked giving that opportunity for other characters to come in.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think what I loved most about the chronology was, as a reader, well, when I'm reading, I feel I have attachments to certain characters and then judgments on other characters, probably the ones I like less. Mm. And as the book revealed more and more and you started maybe hearing a bit more of a backstory about one character, somehow that made it, I sort of was starting to empathise with characters that previously I had not. For example, with Von Rumpel, where he talks about how much his daughters would have loved the model.
Yeah. Yes.
And clearly he's a horrible man in a terrible situation under enormous pressure. But you're written to not like him.
Of course, yeah.
And yet he still allows you glimpses into his humanity.
Yeah.
So it's like shifting goalposts for me on characters, which I liked.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's really good on like moral ambiguity and keeping everyone just human.
100%.
And actually even the characters who you do judge or you do hate, there's still that human element, which I think... some authors kind of struggle to achieve in a as effective a way.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, there are anti-heroes, aren't there? And I don't know if there are necessarily any of those in this book, but we'll get to Verna later, I'm sure. But I mean, it's that moral ambiguity that you want to root for him because you were sort of introduced to him as a young boy, he's 17 really, isn't he? And then younger in other parts of the book. But yeah, he's had a rough childhood and has, you know, didn't want to join the Hitler Youth, but you do still root for him throughout the whole book, or I certainly did, even though you learn about the things he's had to do as part of his job. So yeah, I think that's a good point. So when we were discussing the book early on between us, we were both really struck by how well written the novel was, and we were speaking about this earlier before the podcast started. I think it's just beautiful. And actually I found it really interesting, Jordina, because when we were speaking the other day, because you'd read it before, you then started listening to it on audiobook. And I remember you saying like it hadn't quite had the same impact maybe because it was so beautifully written, sort of seeing it written down almost sort of made it more visual and impactful perhaps.
Yeah, and it's strange. I would say I do 80% of my reading as reading and 20% is the occasional audiobook.
Yeah.
And I just felt like, for me, the sort of rich language, the descriptions and how you can really linger over certain sentences and words, which he really invites you to do in this book, it just didn't kind of land in the same way on the audio. And reading it a second time, I think the first time I was so busy trying to work out the plot and the characters and what was happening and we're here, and just kind of keeping alert to that, that maybe sometimes I didn't get... I mean, it still impacted me, the language, but somehow this time I felt even more appreciative of the way he writes.
So, Bea, how about what were your thoughts on
he's one of those
writing style
writers who just feels like you're in such safe hands, like he's in total command of every sentence. And there's something so sensory about his writing. There's like the salt spray you can feel, and you can like the sizzle of the like omelet that's cooking, and it just feels like there's all of the senses, and he achieves that really well without having at all a kind of flowery or overly descriptive style.
Yeah, 100%.
Which again, I think is really rare.
Yeah, there's a quote actually that I had noted down, which I think kind of demonstrates your point really well. It's quite near the beginning when war's breaking out, and it says, "New rumours arrive. They rustle along the paths of Jardin des Plantes and wind down the museum galleries. They echo in high dusty debouts where shriveled old botanists study exotic masses. The Germans are coming." This idea of the rumours being personified and made, like echoes, saying to you, like kind of wisps travelling through. And just a really short sentence, but Frau Elena paces the parlour, her slippers whispering left, whispering right.
Yeah, I love that.
It's just...
it's great.
Yeah.
Brilliant. It's good. Actually, B, when you were saying about the omelette, I mean, I love food, but I did think the book, especially, I guess, made even more stark because there isn't much food to go around for a lot of the novel. I thought all those descriptions were amazing. The one that really sticks with me is when Verna and Marie-Laure finally open that tin of peaches and she realises it's peaches, it's not gone off beans, it's not, you know, various other things. And she said probably about 400 pages earlier, like she didn't dare dream it was going to be one of Madame's last tins of peaches. But the way they both describe eating those peaches, and I can't remember exactly how it was, but it sounded like they were just sort of slipping all the way down without chewing, and it was just so sweet and sticky, and the way they were sort of both delving their hands in to get the very last of it. Written, I guess, from her perspective with the blindness, like the sensory element of it, and then him sort of saying, you know, he hasn't eaten for a very, very, very long time. Yeah, I think all of that really played in really well.
It's such a beautiful moment that, I was worried about them cutting their hands on the tin. I think the first time he talks about food, it's he's talking about in the children's home, them making cakes out of mustard powder and water.
Yeah.
And I just think about that all the time because how gross. But then the contrast of that to the meal that she receives when she first kind of arrives at her great uncle's and... it's all just very richly evoked and well done.
And the cake that Werner gets when he, early on, when he fixes the radio for that sort of Nazi commander, when he thinks he's in so much trouble, and then he's sort of brought into this amazing house, and he talks about the wife's legs a lot, doesn't he? Because he's just never seen legs like it before. But then he's rewarded with those four slices of cake, and even the way that's described with the icing sugar and everything, I can still visualise it all right now. So he did a very good job of keeping that alive. Somebody else on the community, Gabby, said, "I love the main characters as they're quite, quote-unquote, unusual, a blind girl and an orphan boy. The story's captivating and the ending is bittersweet." So, yeah, we have a little bit already, but let's discuss the two main characters. So, yeah, first up, what did you think of Marie-Laure as a character?
I think she's really strong as a character. I think the way that we kind of are guided through the primary locations, through her experience of them as a young blind girl who is so reliant on everyone around her, I think comes back to his sensory descriptions, the way that he manages to create such a strong sense of place, you know, through her, when actually we're kind of feeling the streets and smelling them, and you know, rather than seeing them, but he still manages to conjure them so well. And I think the way that when we first meet her, she is so powerless, it's and dependent. I mean, at its heart, I think the book is about ordinary people in extraordinary times and just being kind of propelled along, having to go with the flow and hope for the best that you're kind of going to be found on the right side of history. And her blindness is kind of an extension of that. And she goes from this helpless young girl who is completely reliant on the adults in her life to actually somebody with real agency and who is able to kind of find this kind of power in herself to kind of protest and to effect change, and I think that's just really beautifully done.
Yeah,
I've never read a book where I have felt so alert to all the other senses. We've got another quote that we liked, which was Marie-Laure looks up from her book and believes she can smell gasoline under the wind as if a great river of machinery is streaming slowly, irrevocably towards her. It's amazing how that kind of sense of danger she can pick up on through so many other ways than the traditional ways. And I just felt like that sort of seemed to impact and touch everyone she came into contact with as well.
100%. Talking about her blindness, I agree with how her hand was guided through the description. You could really get a sense for things. But another thing that really struck me, it was in the last chapter, I think, where she is obviously back in Paris and she's in her late 90s, I think, isn't she, by then? And she's saying how she can tell what the time of day is by where the flower is, the way the flower's facing in the sunlight on that given day. And I was like, oh yeah. You know, just those little things you just learn as you go along, but also what a lovely picture to have in your head of her sort of telling the time that way. I thought that was gorgeous. So clever.
Yeah, and actually it's quite interesting because it makes you think that maybe it's really there's kind of a common narrative around the idea that if you're blind, you've had something taken away from you. But actually he is writing it as if yes, she doesn't have that sense, but she is richer in all her other senses more than any of us with our full senses. She is kind of beyond.
I think at one stage, doesn't she say that she can hear like a reed rustling 2 miles away? I think when she's in Saint Malo, and it's like, wow.
There's another bit as well where she's describing the colours of her dreams.
Yes.
And it's all really vivid and bright and, you know, it's something I'd never really considered before, for the kind of the mind's eye, how it sees or how it, you know, translate without that actual sight.
That's so true, actually, because there's another bit where she says, like, if you close your eyes like we can, you can still sort of see hints of colour and shadows. And she was like, that doesn't happen for me. And actually, I learnt a lot through that, or it was something I hadn't necessarily considered. And the dream thing kind of came into that as well.
So to Werner, when Werner's about to leave to join the Hitler Youth, his sister Jutta is horrified and says, is it right to do something only because everyone else is doing it? And that, I think, is when we feel that doubt slip into Werner's mind. We see him in countless terrible situations as time goes on and as he's developing as a young man. And it really is a very young man. I think he's recruited when he's about 14.
He's 14,
He's fighting by the time he's 16 or 17. I think it's interesting to think about how Jutta impacts... how Werner thinks about what's going to come and what lies ahead. She seems to have a huge amount of critical thinking and strong moral code for how young she is. And obviously she doesn't know what lies ahead. So I just wondered what we think about how he behaves in the book and how that changes over time.
Yeah, she's kind of the moral voice of the novel, isn't she? We spoke about moral ambiguity and how actually... in a way, he's not trying to kind of tell us what to think about any of the characters. They're all just going along the paths that they feel they have to. And so we judge them for that. And actually, although we do sympathise with him and with his journey, because we've seen him since he was an adorable small child asking lots of questions and you know, figuring out his radios and everything, you still can kind of look at him objectively from the future and think, well, you're... please don't do it. They are doing the wrong thing. But at the same time, in a way, she's the only voice which is maybe just from him, from the author, and actually being kind of properly critical. I think the moment at which he stops just going with the flow and accepting kind of what his country needs of him, that's probably his sister's influence and that kind of voice ringing out through the years. She obviously... still means a huge amount to him, even when she's been that distance. And their relationship is drawn so beautifully at the beginning. So you kind of miss that, I think, as they become separated.
Yeah, definitely. As I found with the two of them, you learnt a lot through the censorship, especially about her, because you were obviously able to read these letters, but a lot of what she's saying is all completely sort of blocked out. So again, she's still... resisting from afar and trying to kind of talk to him about what he might be doing. But I think it's hard, isn't it? Because it's all against his will, isn't it? The only reason he wants to do this in the first place is because he doesn't want to go down the mines. He doesn't want to die like his father did. And I suppose at a young age, when there was all this propaganda around, this seemed a much better option than going down the mines and doing that.
He thought he was going to end up in a kind of technical college in Berlin.
Yeah, that's exactly.
What he thought.
Exactly.
To.
But in terms of Werner, yeah, it's interesting, like, his relationship with Volkheimer as well, because he's sort of presented as the giant, you know, this big, imposing character who all the boys at the school fear. Mm. But actually, their relationship's really nice, I think, the two of them. And although Volkheimer, obviously, I think he says at one stage, he's killed at least 100 men, you know, who were just, as it turns out, just sort of very malnourished people in tiny huts, just working with dodgy equipment, trying to survive themselves. So he does a lot of dreadful things, but it's written in quite a sympathetic way. I don't think you're ever sort of leaning towards hating him or Werner and the things they do. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I don't think he is ever trying to excuse them. And I think it could get quite uncomfortable if he was trying to just be like, actually everyone's just ultimately fine, they're just victims of their history. He's, you know, showing all the kind of the complex sides and showing the bad as well as the sympathetic sides is the strength of that that characterization.
I think that comes across really well actually with the description of some of the commanders in the school. You've got some who seem quite reasonable and seem to, especially at the beginning, but as more and more of them are getting pulled into the war, and then you've got these injured soldiers coming back to run the school, there's definitely things, the war was taking a turn for the worst if you were German, and the school seems to mirror that.
Yes.
There's a quote here that says, Werner is succeeding. He is being loyal. He is being what everybody agrees is good. And yet every time he wakes and buttons his tunic, he feels he is betraying something. And I think clearly that something is the voice in his head from Jutta. Yeah.
Should we talk about Frederick a bit? I found, like I say, that was obviously put in there deliberately. But I think that I did just find that whole storyline awful. A, because there was like all the rules and the games at the school with like being picked the weakest, and then the sort of chasing sort of pack mentality that the boys were having to kind of whip up because of the situation they were in and how they were being trained. But then when I think of Frederick, I also think about that prisoner and the water bucket as well, and that whole situation. Doesn't Werner say to Volkheimer, like, why did we leave him there when he was dead? We should have given him some dignity, I suppose. And then Volkheimer asks, like, why though? And that's sort of brought back in again at the end of the book. Do you think that's probably like the first example in the book of a real life sort of atrocity sort of being shown in full? Like, it's not even being hinted at, it's like right there for the reader to see what they were having to do to people.
Yeah, I guess that up until then, or more broadly, you know, it's all a bit more abstract, isn't
it?
Or a bit more on a kind of grand scale. But then when you see that played out, you know, between individuals and between young people, it's a lot more stark. I think that's quite clever, actually, having the kind of the grand political goings on, but also actually how it's impacting dynamics between ostensibly ordinary young people and what's that's doing to each other.
Yeah, because that's I think why I was bringing him up, because we're talking about Jutta, because I feel I see Frederick as another sort of moral compass, because he's the only boy who doesn't throw the freezing water over the man and keeps refusing, knowing full well that it's going to land him in trouble, and he did it anyway. And Werner is very much like, he didn't want to do it either, but did.
Yeah, and that makes you wonder how many of the other boys didn't want to do it but did.
Yeah.
And as Frederick says, your problem, Werner, is you believe you still have, you still believe you own your life. And Frederick is willing to own his life no matter what.
Yeah.
And I feel like that exercise that they have to do is a real example of how they were being trained to be so inhumane, to be killing machines, because they were trying to strip away any kind of emotion, empathy, anything from these young boys. So that by the time they were in that situation, they could only behave in one way.
Yeah.
And then there's that terrible incident where they end up in Vienna shooting the mother and the daughter by mistake.
Yeah. Mm.
And I felt like that was kind of inevitable.
Yeah.
Are there other characters you'd like to have learned more about that you were kind of curious, left wanting more from?
I really liked Uncle Etienne.
I did.
And I'd like to, I mean, I think there's such a backstory there, obviously, and you get snippets of it, but yeah, I thought he was remarkable.
He's clearly such an intelligent, sort of sensitive intellectual, isn't he? Like, with his library of amazing books.
Yeah.
And obviously we know what happened in World War One and why he became like he did. But yeah, I feel like there's an interesting story there for sure. I'd have loved to learn more about Madame.
Yes.
Like, she feels like she had an awesome life, but as an awe-inspiring, sort of incredible life before even joining the resistance. Like, she was an amazing character. But you just saw enough of her to, like, learn about her, be interested by her, and get a real sense of her and her strength and how she can rally all the sort of older women of the town to kind of do things they never would have thought they would have been, you know, able to do. But it definitely left me wanting more.
Yeah, I agree. She was the one I could read a novel for.
Yeah.
That, can we have that next, please? And I also thought Frau Eleanor, I think that she was this very gentle, calm, quiet character, this real lovely, steady person. And even at the end,
at
the end,
I found that I wasn't expecting that chapter at all.
Well, you're not. Once the minute I saw it, within about two lines, I thought, oh, I'm never this
That, just to remind people, it was the chapter towards the end when Jutta and Eleanor and others get raped by some of the soldiers, that chapter.
Which has been historically reported as being something that was very common.
For me anyway, felt a bit sudden and like, oh wow, it left a big impact.
And I think it's also a really important acknowledgement of the German women who weren't fighting, who had a horrendous time, and at the end had a really horrendous time, and that can be overlooked.
Yeah,
I thought it was really powerful and important that he included that.
And to go back to your point about Frau Eleanor, it's because she says, doesn't she, like, I'll go first because then they'll be more gentle with you afterwards, which I thought was like, horrible. But horrible. Speaks, she still wants to protect them all right till the end, doesn't she?
He's not really a side character, but obviously he's not in the book as much as we would like because he goes to prison, but we haven't really spoken about her father.
I was going to say, the one thing I want to know is what happened, because they just didn't find out, did they?
I quite like that he didn't, that he left that ambiguous. Yeah. So as I know, because you're kind of with them in the not knowing.
Yeah,
and I
true.
Think, you know, that's kind of how it would have been. But yeah, he was a great character as well.
I think also his dedication to her as a young girl, as a single father, as she goes blind, as he walks and measures the streets.
Yeah.
How long must that have taken? Yeah. And then he becomes a suspect in Saint-Malo for doing
that. Bloody claw.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Put over the road.
Yeah, and the informer. Obviously, radio is at the heart of the story and how it brings people together. The lovely side of it being Etienne's broadcasts and that gorgeous music, which yes. in the TV show you get to hear, which mm-hmm. is lovely. It kind of makes us think, I suppose, a bit about how we use modern communication today, that being social media and the mm-hmm. internet, and how we all go in there and instantly get our news fix. Mm. We know exactly what's going on around the world. But how important it was for them to be able to tune in and mm. hear what was happening. There's one quote from the book which says, "Radio, it ties a million ears to a single mouth."
I love that.
Yeah, another wonderful example.
Yeah, just a tiny sentence of about eight words.
How do you think the power of radio worked through the novel?
It just gives it this sense of connectivity, doesn't it? I mean, the fact that these two strangers from kind of other sides of history find each other and they have, you know, that broadcast in common, almost like a mutual friend,
yeah.
having heard her grandfather on the radio all those years ago. And it shows the kind of the common humanity in a way, and I think that's really lovely. I mean, it's hard to kind of imagine today what that must have been mm. like, to have absolutely no way of knowing where your loved ones were or you know, actually really what was going on politically at the time, you know, when all those radios are confiscated and suddenly they're completely cut off.
Yeah, so I did love that bit where he's like, Madame so-and-so wants her husband to know that she's well, yeah. or yeah. reading out these kind of classifieds.
Yeah,
yeah.
I felt that was really heartwarming. If you were listening to that, and even mm. if you didn't know any of the people, yeah. just knowing what people were doing yeah. and what was happening would be really comforting.
Mm. Somebody else on the community has said, "I don't know if anybody else felt like this, but the whole book I was just waiting for Verna and Marie-Law to meet. I kept thinking to myself, please tell me they're meant to find each other." That was Vanessa on the community. How did you feel when this finally happened? And yeah, did it meet your expectations?
There is just this kind of constant momentum from the beginning, because you do, I mean, like Vanessa's right, you are just expecting it to happen all along and you're just kind of waiting for it, and it feels like that momentum is just kind of building and building throughout. So yeah, it's actually really sweet when it does happen. I think I'm right in saying that chronologically, as we're reading it, but not in the chronology of the novel, yeah. if that makes sense. He hears her before we see them meeting.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think it's really nice that is kind of on her terms, because it's audio, and so it's, you know, she's not missing from that interaction, as it were. And there's something really lovely about that, and the fact that he's so compelled by her voice, and it's actually her just sitting there kind of reading from the Braille. And although I think that is actually later on in their time frame, I really like the way that he did that. When they actually meet in person, we spoke about the moment with the peaches, which is just so gorgeous.
Yeah.
And actually it's quite fleeting in a way. But it's just perfectly done, and you kind of almost want more from it, but feels more real that way.
I think so. And probably what would have happened, yeah. like say, at the time, like it wasn't like they were going to be, oh, let's just stay here for a few days and get to know each other and interact. Like, it really did have to be quick. But am I right in thinking that, because he saw her, didn't he, before yeah. they had that interaction in the house? He'd seen her sort of walking, and he'd sort of put two and two together. Because wasn't he about to knock on the door to introduce himself?
Yeah.
And then she opens the door and just goes off to get the bread.
Yeah.
So I thought that was quite nice in a way. But then actually quite interesting based on what you were saying, because, yeah, she wasn't aware of that interaction, yeah. so actually
she wasn't aware of either of those ones.
Yeah,
but some,
yeah,
you know, in kind of different ways.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, so I feel like, in terms of who's invested more in, it's not a relationship, but let's call it that. Clearly, him, because he's heard her voice. So I think he feels this pull and this connection towards her that, well, she has no idea who he is.
It's so true. Yeah.
So it's pretty one-sided.
Yeah,
you're right. Actually,
in a way, but as a reader, I don't think you feel it's one-sided. As a reader, you feel that he's almost, well, he's kind of coming in and saving the day, isn't
yeah.
he, as well? So suddenly that equalises it maybe
yeah.
again.
That's so interesting you say that, actually. I hadn't really made that connection. But actually in that final chapter when she's meeting Jutta, she kind of says, like, oh, you know, the sister of the boy I met very fleetingly back yeah. in 1944. Like, obviously she then goes on to say about how he'd saved her life three times, mm-hmm. but actually she makes it sound as though she's not thinking about him every single day, or, you know, mm-hmm. Obviously he had a big impact on her life and saving her life, but actually, yeah, she wasn't mooning over him or thinking about mm-hmm. him the whole time before. It was just a very short interaction for her.
Yeah.
Whereas he had a much longer
short.
Yeah, yeah, had a yeah. much longer interaction with her than she realised. Interesting.
It is interesting.
What do you think about the Sea of Flames? Because it's obviously got a lot of power over a lot of characters. And I was just wondering as well, like, it was a bit more of a supernatural element in what was otherwise a sort of historical novel.
Well, I think firstly it was a way to kind of throw those characters into the action in a way and kind of give them a sense of jeopardy. So I think that was quite clever. I also think that there is something quite kind of fairy tale-ish about the novel, both, you know, for this storyline and also that, you know, we spoke about him kind of appearing at the end almost as that like knight in shining armor. Yeah. There is something almost like a modern fairy tale in it, and so I think it worked in that sense. For me, it wasn't the kind of storyline that I connected most from it, but I think it was a really useful device. And we spoke at the beginning about how this is a book which connects with lots of different kinds of readers, and I think actually it's quite helpful in that sense as well, because there is something almost fantastical about it, which I think will hook someone who doesn't necessarily usually opt for traditional historical storytelling.
I think that's a really good point. Georgina, how did you feel?
Not for me, that bit. I have to be honest. I mean, this book for me is clearly a 10 out of 10. But I would go to a 9.8 on that. Because I just don't love anything sci-fi or supernatural. I don't love any magical realism. I don't love any of that kind of stuff. I'm just like, oh, for God's sake, it's a stone.
Yeah.
Like, come on. I do like it as a device. Because I think it gives, it helps with the pace.
Yeah.
That's why they're all, you know, pulling themselves towards this house, which is the only house still standing, it was seen, for miles around. So that lends itself into that, which is useful. But, oh, God, I'd be with Verna. I'd just chuck it in the sea. Good riddance.
Yeah, I mean, clearly,
maybe it's a bit of fun, a bit of magic.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I could have done without it. Yeah. But I don't know how we would have otherwise got the characters to all be in one place. So it is clever.
I think, was like a bit of a respectful distance from the supernatural. So I was still a bit like, oh, it's just what people are thinking and saying.
Yeah.
I think it's more a sort of metaphor for power at large anyway. Like, there had to be something more to it because, he probably would have just thrown in the towel, wouldn't he? Like, being like, oh, well, I don't need this.
I could pass off.
Exactly,
one of the
exactly, no exactly. Yeah. So there had to be, like, something else that pulled him in. And I think, obviously, his illness and tumours and everything, which, as a side note, again, going back to the language, like, I hadn't really thought about it before. It was so descriptive, but he was kept describing his tumour as being, like, vines growing inside him and around him, and again I just found that so visual. Like, really, as his, over the years as he got sort of progressively more ill, I found that like an amazing way of describing how the tumor was spreading and where to. But I kind of feel like, I guess he had to have an illness and had to have something. I could handle it, let's say. It didn't spoil it for me.
It didn't spoil it for me either. The end of the book gives us a look into many of the main characters' futures. Did you like learning more, and were you surprised by any of their fates?
I did. I don't always like that kind of skip ahead. I'm quite a fan of an ambiguous ending, and I quite like sometimes, you know, it just ending without those kind of subsequent endings. But I do think it was helpful in this case, bringing them together and getting a little bit of a sense of closure, because I think there are those kind of slightly fairy tale-y elements of the plot, and there is a little bit of a kind of suspension of disbelief required. It relies quite heavily on coincidence, in a way that I think if you didn't have that, you know, story tied up and then brought together again, I think it would have felt like we were lacking something. I probably could have lived without, although it was nice and it ended it quite sweetly, I think I could have lived without the 2014.
I agree. Yeah. It was, like you say, nice. Like a nice
full stop.
Exactly. But I don't think it was 100% needed, that one. Like, nice to know they met and realised and everything. But I don't think it was necessary.
Oh, I disagree.
That's good. That's what we like.
Why did you like it? I do not like ambiguous endings. I like it. Neatly parceled up with a big bow on the top. This is one of the reasons I just felt so satisfied and happy when this book ended. Because it's so traumatic and so many terrible, terrible things happen. and it is, you know, person against person, mm-hmm. and it's brutal. And I just felt that there was so much kind of closure, to mm-hmm. use our modern term, and I felt that after reading what happened to Jutta, to know that she had managed to move past that,
that's
to
true.
Get married, yeah. and to mm-hmm. have a child, and to have a kind of quiet, normal life that mm-hmm. she was content to have. Mm-hmm. I also felt really touched by the amount of volunteer organisations there must be. What is returned to her is a canvas bag, mm. a wooden box, and a piece of an envelope.
Yeah.
It's not a lot.
No.
But someone has spent 20 years trying to get those yeah. things yeah. to the right person. And I just found that really moving.
Yeah.
So I liked that. And then with the 2014 bit, oh, I don't know. I just thought it was really cute. It was just cute. It was cute, just good. Sweet, you know? I agree, you didn't need it. But I also did, I liked hearing about how, what she had done in her career.
I actually got back to like that. Yeah. I also quite liked that she was like, oh, we had a child, but we didn't want to live together. You know, I like, she's still got that fierce independence.
Yes. Yeah.
And her daughter has as well, by the sound of things, in the book. But then she's still like, but we all go for lunch every Friday. I was like, that's yeah. like French and civilised.
Completely. And yet she still was counting the drain covers
yeah.
on the way back to her apartment, the apartment yeah. she had grown up in.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of sweet too.
Interesting. I'm trying to think. I liked the Volkheimer bit because yeah. I did, like I said earlier, I did warm to him as a character, even though he did very horrible things. He was, again, only 17, 18, 19 when he was doing them. I'm not forgiving him at all. But, you know, I do think we have to remember that they were kids and they were forced to do things. But I liked that he had a bit of a redemption arc, but it felt realistic. Like yeah. he's very much a loner, still working in sort of aerials and that yeah. sort of thing, which he probably would be doing. It's the thing he knows how to do.
Yeah.
But he was still sort of respectful of Werner's memory, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I did like that bit.
Mm.
Yeah.
What the ending does do, whilst it is sweet and cute and lovely, it also is really powerful because yeah. it's like the damage is going on for generations, yeah. for generations and for generations, and it's still being yeah. felt by people.
But there's still hope. As there in, is, yeah, still,
there's still
like
hope,
people but... can still have a vaguely happy ending despite living through all that.
Yeah,
it's contextualizing it for today as well, isn't it? Because it's showing how the reverberations are still being felt and how that story of just two ordinary people is still relevant.
Yeah, and I suppose the fear is of forgetting as these generations. Yeah. You know, she's in her 90s.
Yeah,
and this generation, as they die, then. Who is going to remember? Yeah. You know, telling their grandchildren, passing it all on, it's really important.
Mm. Finally, on this section, what did you think of the TV adaptation? Did you watch it? And if so, what did you think? Be honest, is what I'm going to say, because I didn't see
it. We always see Will.
It's just really different. I think it's always really interesting to see how different people interpret these stories. And it's... You know, obviously the chronology of it is different, the way they've chosen to kind of portray the timeline is completely different, and immediately so. I think it did some of it successfully, but it's not the same story.
No.
And it's always really, I think anything that gets people talking about books and interesting in books is a good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, when that when the TV series first aired, sales of All the Light We Cannot See, the book, went up by 85% instantly. Wow. And then they kind of carried on with that uplift, like, you know, in the coming weeks, obviously it's December as well, but still that kind of uplift and increased interest in it continues. I mean, we're sitting here talking about it this year as opposed to, you know, several years ago. And so I think that's a great thing. And anyone who picks up this book as a result of the TV programme being aired is going to discover something brilliant, and then maybe they'll love it and they'll think, oh, what can I move on to next, and they'll read more as a result this year than they would have done. I didn't love the show but I do think that it did it justice in some ways, and I'm thrilled that we're talking about it now.
That's true. I think that's a good point. I only watched the first two episodes because I was just like, oh no, it's not doing it for me. I think it's just, it was the messing with the chronology, and also not just that, but it felt like, Werner and Mary Law met really early on, which I was like, well, you're then the whole, like, will they, won't they? Obviously they will, but the whole, like, waiting for that to happen, that bit, you're sort of almost robbed of that a little bit. Mm. I think it's mainly the Von Rumpel things. Like, he really, we would say he's almost like a sort of pantomime villain a bit more.
Yeah.
Like, what was he doing sort of wrestling her down in that, you know, that watery cove bit? Like, that was just, like, really completely different. He's not like this haunting presence who she can hear, and she's like, oh, where's the guy who's sort of dragging his leg and stalking me? There was none of that tension. It was just like immediately like, right, a fight. And also I just found it a bit unbelievable as well, the way he was going round to everyone in the town being like, there's a blind girl, where does she live? And they were all refusing to tell him. But then she was walking around the town all the time with her cane. Like, surely...
Yeah,
he was also walking around all the time as well. So I'm like, surely he could have just been like, aha, there she is. Like, yeah, I don't know. I just found that, like, super unbelievable. But, you know.
It's harder to achieve that kind of tension visually, though, isn't it? I mean, I think it's a lot more on the nose. But that's because, you know, we're not dealing with a really brilliant author's very subtle way of writing. And, you know, in the same way that part of the reason I think that the adaptation is missing some of the kind of heart of the book is because we don't get that language that we've been talking about, which is so central to why it's unique and why it's great. And you're missing that kind of sensory input. Instead, it's showing, not telling. And so it's much harder to be subtle.
For me, the problem is the casting.
Yeah.
You know, you've got... the actress is 30, he's 26. They're both meant to be playing
kids,
15-year-olds.
It's true.
And they didn't, it just didn't pass for me. And there's one point quite early on where he's in the orphanage, cast as the person he is as an adult. That actor is now him. And he just looks completely ridiculous.
Well, he's got short
shorts and they put him on this little chair. Like the
chair he's got slightly longer hair.
When they're 5 years old, you know. And it's sort of odd. It's really odd. Mm. And Mark Ruffalo's accent was, I don't even know what it was meant to be. It was a bit like Dick Van Dyke doing the Cockney accent in Mary Poppins. And it was all over the place. But my favourite person actually was Hugh Laurie as Etienne.
I found
that, and Madame Manek. I thought they were both really convincing.
Yeah. And the other thing I would say is that both of the actresses who played Mary Law were blind as well. And I think that's amazing to like do that properly and not that's just a good cast decision. Somebody else, you know.
Mm.
Yeah, so I thought that was successful. Anyway, I will watch the other two episodes to tie a bow on it, as you say, Georgina. But yeah, so far, not convinced.
It's beautifully shot.
Oh, yeah. The soundtrack's gorgeous. Yeah,
and when you see those big bombers flying in and the leaflets falling from the sky and things, I mean, it is amazing.
Yeah, there's a team behind, like, Peaky Blinders and other, like, shows like that, so they know what they're doing. But yeah, just kind of. It's hard to adapt
anything
like that.
Yeah, for sure.
Isn't it? But no. Well, thank you very much. That was a fascinating chat. And B, we're just going to talk a little bit about you.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
If that's okay. So yeah, obviously, head of books at Waterstone sounds like a lot of people's dream job. What does your sort of day-to-day look like? Or what does a head of books do?
So it's quite different, really, depending on time of year in terms of what the typical day is. We've just come through our big Christmas rush, which is obviously our busiest time of year. So for those months, it's very much all about making sure that the books are in the bookshops, the booksellers have everything they need to talk about them and to recommend to customers, and the bookshops are all as welcoming places as they possibly could be. As we kind of look ahead to the new year, our team, so we kind of work with publishers on their forthcoming publications and in kind of launching our favourite books with as much impact and fun as possible to get them to as wide a readerships as we can. So we are currently starting to work with publishers on their autumn list for this year.
Oh, yeah, no, it's like anything like this, isn't it? Everything's so much further in advance than you think.
Yeah, so that's really fun. So my team is, you know, we kind of look after the buying as well as things like events and kind of online strategy and things like that. So yeah, we're just making plans really for the year ahead.
How many books do you think you have to get through, you know, on average in a month, say? You must, or maybe it goes in cycles, but it feels like you must have to read quite a lot to kind of pick which those books are.
Yeah, lots. So last year for this kind of stage, we saw about 5,000 books for the next 6 months, and that's not everything, but it's the, you know, the books that we kind of would want to be doing something, you know, putting a bit of effort behind. But we've got an amazing team, and we've got the benefit of, you know, booksellers all over the country who are very engaged and who are brilliant readers. So we get an awful lot of feedback from all of them. And so it means that, you know, we've got a great kind of network of people who read really, really widely. So it's not just, you know, a couple of people sitting in an office thinking, I look like the look of that.
Like this, like trying to get through.
So, yeah, I mean, we read a lot. You know, we kind of also have really trusted relationships with publishers and everything. So we, you know, we have a good head start in terms of how to make that initial kind of whittling down what to read first, what you absolutely have to go to right away. But yeah, that's a fun part of the job, really.
Fascinating. Top three okay. read in the last few months.
That are out already. Or,
yeah. Well, I think out already. Would okay. be helpful. Yeah.
So we launched a prize last year, so it's kind of going into our third year for debut fiction, Waterstones debut fiction prize, and our winner, which was announced in August, was Alice Wynn for In Memoriam.
Oh, so good.
Did you like it?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Amazing.
It's just a glorious piece of historical fiction, which I think fans of All the Light Will Pass You really love.
When you said that, actually, it's a good companion piece.
You must. It's it's set in the First World War. It's about these two boys, basically, who meet at a school. They have a very kind of privileged upbringing, and then they both find themselves kind of going off to the trenches. And it's a very kind of brutal depiction of that, but underpinned by a really gorgeous, tender love story between them. And they both kind of go off to war, kind of secretly loving each other. And then, you know, as the events unfold, they are kind of brought together, and it's kind of the lights we found in dark places and all of that. But it's structured interestingly as well, in the same way that All the Light is. It's more chronological, but the chapters are kind of split up by these In Memoriam sections of their school newspaper, and so you kind of learn of characters who are kind of missing or dying, just as you would have done at the time through these kind of In Memoriam pieces. And that's what inspired Alice to write the book, because she found those articles from her own school archives, and she was just completely fascinated. And so this novel kind of came about as a result of that. And it's really, really gorgeous. It's her first novel, but it's just so assured. Did you like it?
I did. I thought it was amazing.
So that was one of the absolute highlights of the last year. We had another book on our shortlist called Calla by Colin Walsh, which was personally one of my absolute favourites.
I've not read that yet, but I remember reading about it and writing something up on it for SL Man because it sounded amazing, the plot.
It's brilliant. It's kind of partly this coming-of-age story of six friends in kind of seaside Ireland, and the dynamics of this kind of this group of friends and how, you know, awful you can be to each other when you're a teenager, but also how kind of formative those relationships are. And then it's partly this kind of missing girl thriller set when three of those friends in their kind of late 20s come back to the town to kind of try and uncover what happened to one of the others. And he manages to kind of pull both of those threads together really, really well. So it's very satisfying, both for readers of kind of like character focused fiction, but also a bit more kind of crimey taste as well.
It sounds so
very
good.
Very clever.
Well, if it's satisfying at the end,
you'll be satisfied. If we can look ahead for the next few months.
Yes. I'd love to know your 2024
highlights.
Yeah,
yes.
What
so
are you excited about?
There is so much. It's an incredibly strong year for fiction. Lots and lots of amazing kind of beloved authors coming back with new books, so lots for readers of every taste. If I concentrate on three, so in a couple of weeks' time, the first kind of massive big moment is The Fury by Alex Michaelides, the author of The Silent Patient. So it's a kind of locked room thriller set on a Greek island, lots of intrigue, very glamorous cast of characters, and the most deliciously unreliable narrator. Absolutely despicable. And it's just so much fun, but also incredibly clever It's full of kind of Shakespearean drama and kind of Agatha Christie-esque kind of details. So that's a really, really fun one.
Like I know.
Possible contender for a
podcast. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Or it sounds like I want to go to Greece and read on a beach. Yeah.
You should do both.
Just honestly. Watch a bat while you're there.
Yeah. And it's fantastic. And yeah, will be a really great one for like summer reading as yeah. well. Looking ahead, but that's coming out on the 1st of February. David Nichols, author yes. of One Day.
So I'm so excited about this.
His new one is called You Are Here, and that's out in a few months' time. And it's this really gorgeous kind of will they, won't they. Love story set over 10 days of the coast to coast walk. His novels are always so kind of full of heart and so wise, but this one, I think, if I'm allowed to say, it's even better than One Day. It's just so satisfying, so well done. And he writes really well on kind of, you know, budding romance, but also on loneliness and yeah. not just its kind of negative side. And I think that's really rare to see in fiction. So I really loved that, and I think it's going to be huge. So that's probably the biggest book of the year. There's also some really incredible debut fiction coming out. We're kind of racing through all of that at the moment, judging for this year's prize.
Yeah, of course.
One which I'm really excited about is called Marta, and it's by an author called Kaveh Akbar, about an Iranian-American boy who's kind of coming of age in the States and trying to kind of reconcile the loss of his parents and struggling with addiction and with... you know, kind of trying to make his way as an artist. I read an awful lot, as discussed, but I was blown away by it.
Oh, wow.
I read it on Christmas Day, and all of my photos from Christmas Day are of paragraphs.
Oh,
of,
wow.
You know, because his writing is just that strong. You just kind of want to remember snippets of it.
Oh, that's great.
So that's really exciting.
Finally, just because I'm sure everyone always says, like, oh, I might write a novel, or everyone, you know, I've got one novel in me. Mm. Have you got any tips for people who, you know, might be budding authors?
I would say read a lot and read widely. And don't be kind of tempted to kind of try to stick to trends, because trends come and go quite quickly and can be quite fickle. And actually, if you write what you know and what you're good at, that's always going to kind of stand up above any kind of any trends that are going on at the given moment. Also, I think just do it for the love of it, because it's really competitive and it's hard. And that always shines through. You can always really tell when someone has written a book with love and with care. So persevere, but enjoy the process, and that will always kind of work in the end.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Bea, for coming on. That's all been brilliant. Loved all your insights on the Verfkin.
Yeah,
can't wait to read some of those books you just recommended. So just before we go, we've got one announcement, which is that the next Sheerlux Book Club read will be Tom Lake by Anne Patchett. Have you read that?
I love Tom Lake.
Yeah. Okay, all three of us have read it and love it. So yeah, and we're being joined by journalist, author and broadcaster Bryony Gordon on the next podcast, which is really exciting as well. So yeah, make sure you join in the discussions on the Sheerlux community and ask any questions you've got for Bryony and Georgina and I on the book. Thank you so much for watching and listening. If you've got any questions, please do email us at podcast@sheerlux.com. We love hearing from you, and we'll see you next time. Thank you. Goodbye.